This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris with...
And I'm Julian Ng. Good morning,
Good
people.
Good morning. Well, great to be back with you after the weekend. And what a weekend it's been. Yesterday, Father's Day to all those fathers celebrating and daughters and sons appreciating your dads. Yesterday was the day to do it. I couldn't get a booking at a restaurant for dinner at all because everywhere was booked.
Why am I not surprised about that?
That's right.
So what did you end up doing?
Just going to... a place down the road in Tamantun. So, you know, it was just a neighborhood joint that I knew I could get a table at.
Talking about that, you know, the queue and the jam outside Tamantun yesterday was just crazy because people were flocking to the bazaar, the Buka Puasa
Ramadan, yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, I love that place. One of my favorite Pasar Ramadans during the fasting month.
The lemang and the rendang there are very good.
Not a promotion in any way, but yeah, that is quite good. All right. Other things that happened over the weekend was the twin by-elections in Sungai Besar and Kuala Kangsar. So that was quite a surprise, I guess, some surprising for some and in other ways unsurprising because in first place was Barisan Nasional. I would say first place, like it was a race. It was a race, in fact. Barisan Nasional had a decisive victory, especially in Sungai Besar, where they saw a 9,000 plus vote majority. That is 23 times the vote majority that they got in the 2013 general elections.
Yeah, and in Kuala Kangsar as well, the vote majority was about 7,000. I think this is a case of the opposition votes being split, isn't it? Because the others votes had to go to Amanah and PAS, and you add them up together, you still get a majority for Barisan Nasional, but in the region of 1,000 or 2,000.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, in the lead up to the by-elections, we were talking to quite a number of analysts, and they seem to think, well, you know, it's bound to be a Barisan win, but we should be looking closely at the second and third place and how that turns out. And in Kuala Kangsar, PAS came in second ahead of Amanah by 800 votes. Whereas in Sungai Besar, which is one of the really interesting seats, Amanah came ahead of PAS by 707 votes. So that was really quite interesting to see. I guess all in all, we want to break down what happened and what the results mean. So a large part of our programming today is going to be focused on kind of taking a closer look at the results. At 8:35 a.m. today, we're going to be speaking to Ben Sufian of the independent polling outfit Merdeka Center for his take on the results. Also, on Pressing Matters, P. Gunasegaran will be joining us at 9:35 a.m. to discuss his view of what happened. He was, in fact, in Sakinchan giving... invited to be on a panel with Arul Kanda of
Ooh, this is Guna, really?
Yes, yeah. So
amazing.
So quite, and he was invited to talk about money laundering, and this is going to be quite interesting. We'll get his take on what actually happened there and what he saw on the ground in Sungai Besar, and his take on the results.
I'm just wondering, did this issue's feature come to the top in the elections?
Well, actually, that's the funny thing. I think for each of the component part, each of the contesting parties, they all had a different, shall we say, a different demon to contend with. With PAS, it was the private members bill. With Barisan, it was the 1MDB controversy. And with Amanah, it was the relative unknownness of that. Of, you know, it's a new entity, so a lot of people weren't sure what they stood for. And they had to deal with that. And it was, I guess, quite interesting that Barisan brought down the big guns. They brought down Arul, they brought down Najib to go campaigning on the ground to actually address the 1MDB scandal. And clearly, by the decisive victory that we saw, it worked. I guess it worked in a big way. But we want to know why exactly it worked. Analysts are saying there was a huge swing in the Chinese vote. So why exactly did that happen? Let's find out more with our commentators today. 5 minutes past six, taking a look at the week ahead. Julian, this is going to be both a busy week on the global front, but also a kind of relaxed week for us because it's a holiday shortened work week with a public holiday smack in the middle of the week on Wednesday. So that's something to look forward to, I guess, in a way.
For sure, for sure. I'm looking forward to that.
But, you know, sometimes shortened work weeks, especially midweek public holidays, tend to have that start-stop nature when you're just about to get down to productivity.
I'll take what I'll get. I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't reject it.
You're not complaining. Okay, on Thursday, we're going to see the UK referendum on EU membership. So all the market talk about a Brexit, it all boils down to this Thursday. And given the time difference, we will likely get early results by Thursday night or Friday morning.
Yeah, I think this is something that very much focuses on the whole world. And some commentators are saying, of course, that Britain should not be afraid of the fallouts of Brexit because they have to chart their long-term future.
You know, to be honest with you, I've read a couple of really smart, well-argued pieces for the Remain camp, but I've yet to really read a well-argued piece on the Leave camp. And I wonder whether that's because the exit side is more of an emotive side. So you have to be in Britain, you know, feeling the sentiment of on the ground to really get why people are leaning towards exit.
I think it's also the case that we are reading a lot of business publication and a lot of this would have an editorial skew towards staying in Brexit. Otherwise, they are talking about extreme fallout of leaving for the whole world. But really, this is not one of an economic issue, but really about the destiny of the British. Of course, in the short term, there would be fallout. So the Leave camp would argue. But over the long term, what would they do to the United Kingdom, because the UK can forge alliances with other people, in particular the United States, which is also a very big economic might. And the UK themselves are a very big part of the global economy. So over the long term, they can survive and add that flavour of independence on, you know, their own destiny.
What do you think? I mean, do you think it is as close as the polls want to lead us to thinking?
Well, you know, it's very unpredictable. At the end of the day, it's all about greed and fear, isn't it? How greedy you are for more money and how fearful you are with the loss of it. So I think that would rule in the end.
Today is also World Refugee Day, Monday the 20th of June. So on the Breakfast Grill, we're going to have Richard Toll, the representative of UNHCR Malaysia, that is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Now, there have been reports that Rohingyas arriving on boats have been turned away from Malaysian shores, and that's put Malaysia in the international spotlight. UNHCR have strongly condemned the move to turn the refugees away. But what exactly is the role of the UN in helping resolve this crisis?
I think that's a key question. Also a question about whether the UN is working or not. We've discussed this sometime last week. And of course, concern that the international humanitarian system is broken and this has become kind of a machinery that has lost track of what it's for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the criticism about the international humanitarian system is that it's become far too expensive, it's inefficient. Who holds accountability for it and where in the power seems to be concentrated in the hands of the few. So I guess today what we could also discuss on the Breakfast Grill is what is the solution then? How do you ensure that aid is distributed in a fair manner to those who need it the most? So in conjunction with World Refugee Day, we're going to be sitting down with Richard Toll, UNHCR's Malaysian representative, for an in-depth look at the complexities of the refugee crisis. That is after the 8 o'clock news bulletin. So that's on the Breakfast Grill.
Actually, some of the numbers are quite interesting and quite startling as well. 150 over 1,000 refugees and asylum seekers who are registered with the UNHCR in Malaysia as of April this year. And UNHCR Malaysia states that almost 140,000 are from Myanmar, comprising mainly of the Rohingyas and the Chins.
Well, that is is a significant majority. So almost all of the refugees here are from Myanmar. You've got other countries, including Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Afghanistan, as well as Palestine. That makes up the other part of the refugees here. But it's interesting because Malaysia is not party to the convention and protocol relating to the status of refugees. So technically, the government doesn't officially recognize the status of refugees. So that that renders them without any legal or immigration status. So they're kind of caught in this limbo with no access to education, no access to medical care or job opportunities. They can't work here. So I guess this year, UNHCR wants to launch this program called Stand With Refugees. And it's a petition as well. So you can sign it. Please sign the hashtag with a refugees petition. And part of this petition is requesting governments to ensure that every refugee child gets an education, every refugee family has somewhere safe to live, and that every refugee can work or learn new skills. I guess that's important because if you look at the European Union, Germany, for instance, they are they're trying really hard to kind of assimilate the refugees into the community, giving them refugee status, finding them a place to live, getting them a job so that they can contribute to the community.
Yep, and I think this kind of plight is also increasingly made very challenging by the rising conservatism globally. You have Donald Trumps of the world speaking yes. out against a kind of xenophobia, unjustified xenophobia against all these refugees. But it's a huge problem that I guess we need to address because these are human beings and we need to subscribe to humanitarian ideals about how to treat them.
Well, Refugee Today, the 20th of June, the campaign is Stand With Refugees. Please sign that petition, hashtag with refugees. In other news, SPAD has submitted a proposal. So this is part of its Taxi Industry Transformation Program proposal. SPAD, or SPAD, the Land Public Transport Commission, they are recommending to legalize Uber and Grab. And on the other side is that they want to create a level playing field for the taxi drivers so they have a fair chance of remaining competitive.
I think this is the right step to take and to alleviate the problems of the taxi drivers. The issuance of the new taxi licenses is one way to reduce the cost of renting a taxi, which right now is being saddled with the rent-seeking procedures for taxi drivers. And if you eliminate that, that would actually, I guess, give a good run for the money for these new ride-sharing apps. I think the government has the ability to be on the side of the taxi drivers by removing those very costly factors, the rentals of the taxi drivers.
I was surprised when I read this because, I mean, this feels like quite a radical step for SPAD to be taking to say, okay, we understand that the budget, the leasing model for the current taxi drivers seem to are burdening them. So they want to issue new individual taxi licenses. We understand that now they want to allow more vehicle model options to be taxis now. So I guess that question is, you know, what does that mean for Proton? Because that seemed to be the dominant car model that is the make for taxis, right?
That's right. I think that we need to raise the standards of the quality of our taxis and therefore providing more vehicle options would be a good move. And also, I guess this is a kind of mea culpa stance that maintaining the old system is really very hard to justify ideologically. I mean, if you have had, if this was managed properly over the years, then maybe you have a chance of defending this. Mm. But principally, this is very hard to defend because this is all about rent seeking.
Yeah, already we've seen backlash from the taxi drivers community. So I guess we'll have to see whether this actually plays out. In fact, we could even see this pass through Parliament by July, the end of the month. So we'll have to see whether this actually plays out.
I say kudos to SPAD for responding to what people want.
I do. I'm quite heartened by this move. Good job for the proposals. I'm hoping that they are passed as is. It's 6:15 now. Our discussion continues in just a couple of minutes. So keep it right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. Good morning. It's 6:20 on Monday, the 20th of June. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng. Now, can you stop someone committing a crime by giving them cash? Well, there's a pilot project in Richmond, California that tries to prevent crime through cash handouts. Organizers say that it's working and they want to roll this program out across America. So here's Devon Bogan, the man behind the program, explaining exactly how it works.
I think about who these young men are, and I think they've got to be involved rather than get this young man a job. Quite frankly, they're not ready for a job. And when you dig a little deeper, what you learn is they don't even want a job. They want money. The way that it works is that after 6 months of their 18-month fellowship, they become eligible to receive this cash stipend. What does that do? It translates into a 75% reduction in firearm-related murders. This is about keeping young men alive. This is about stopping shootings. The city is much safer. Everything else we've tried has not been successful.
There you go. That was Devon Bogan, the man in Richmond, California, behind the Cash for Criminals program, which is what the media has dubbed it, explaining how it works by giving potential young men who have the potential to be involved in street violence, giving them a stipend to stay off the streets. What do you think about this, Jules?
It's kind of unsettling, isn't it? A lot of us would think that this is quite warped, but if you look at the numbers, $9,000 to be paid to them is a lot less than the $400,000 that the US government would spend on a murder. Mm. So this would seem like a good deal for the government.
Yeah, so if there was a street shooting, for instance, that would mean the cost for emergency and medical care, police costs, legal fees, prison costs, security enhancements, all that add up to about $400,000. But if you look at this program, it is about $9,000 per person for the stipend. And that's a fraction of the cost. And it seems to be working. Because, I mean, you heard in the beginning of that clip, what's his name? Devon said that it's not about giving them jobs. They're not ready for jobs. They can't keep a job. They want money. That's why they're involved in street crime. So by giving them money and having them be part of this fellowship, it seems to keep them off the streets. But there's something fundamentally wrong about the idea of giving someone money not to commit a crime.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive. And a lot of detractors would argue that this will create a kind of very mercenary society that needs to be paid in order to be stopped from committing criminal acts. But, you know, I think that a lot of the problems, social problems that we see today are caused by poverty anyway. So if you pay people some money, then they can think of doing other things with their life apart from trying to make ends meet. And one of the ways include getting involved in crime, like robbing somebody and stealing and so on. So if you paid those people, it would count as a sort of social program. I mean, you know, we are involved, we do spend a lot of money on social programs anyway. Why not pay people who are down and out to keep them out of crime?
But, you know, the detractors argue that this seems to be like a short-term solution, because what happens after that 9,000 runs out, right? I mean, you don't, these young men, they're not equipped to join the workforce. They don't want to join the workforce, as we've heard Devon say earlier. But the other element of this program, which is aside from the cash handout, is the fellowship. Now, what this means is that they've got these hardened ex-criminals, ex-cons who have kind of turned a new leaf and are now contributing to society. They are considered mentors. So they've got this program, this fellowship program, and they will tie up with these young men as mentors. And if the young men stay with the program for more than a stipulated amount of time, they keep getting the stipend. So it's also money plus mentorship, which is perhaps what the kind of wayward delinquents need, right?
Actually, my problem with this is not whether or not we should be on this program. I think we should, but how to apply this evenly to everybody. I mean, the other people who are trying to make ends meet, who are in the throes of poverty and who don't commit any crime, would say, hey, what about us?
Right.
What kind of rewards would we get? So we need to have some ways of applying this evenly, and that would equate to some kind of social program for everybody. You know, you need to provide education for everybody. You need to provide affordable homes and healthcare and nourishment to everybody. Instead of just singling out a particular group to give them money.
I'm so surprised that this program has brought down the shooting, death by shooting rate by 75%. It seems that, according to that clip, he said that nothing else that they have tried in the past few years has actually worked. Now, I'm really kind of amazed by this. How is this just kind of an isolated case, or do you think this is something that can work not just in the States but across the world, right? I mean, with the US, it's a different kind of environment with the gun laws there. But does that mean for everything, for everywhere around the world, that cash handouts are in fact the best way to get people, potential criminals,
well,
not to commit crime?
I would say that it's the elimination of poverty or the reduction of it that would reduce crime.
Through cash handouts, though? That's the best way?
That's one way. The other ways are education. If you have more time to think about things rather than just spending all your time and effort thinking about where your next meal would come from, then you would have time to educate yourself, to look into other things rather than just be engaged in criminal activities. So I think it's not just the money per se, is about time spent on other things like educating yourself.
I don't know why, but this kind of analogy keeps coming up in my head. It feels like, you know, whenever you hear of crimes of snatch theft, right? They always say, let go of the purse or let go of the handbag because there's nothing in there that's more valuable than your life. So it almost feels like, well, take my money, take it, but you know, I don't want the crime on me. I wonder, it feels a little bit like that, like, oh, take this money, but don't hurt me, in a small way, like a ransom. I'm being held at ransom by giving them a stipend. What do you think about that?
Well, we have to look into the causes and effects of why snatch thefts occur. Mm-hmm. Usually, you won't see a rich person or a well-informed person going out on the streets and doing that kind of thing. And that's because that person would have had a chance of education and a chance of getting a place and employment in society that prevents them from going into this kind of activity. So we really need to look at the causal effects of why snatch thefts and other crimes happen. To prevent that, we can use, very crudely say, you know, we can throw money at the problem. I think that's a symptom of what we need to do. But really, the symptom is that these guys need to make a living and they don't have. I'm not saying it's right.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that perhaps they don't have a choice.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating kind of social experiment for me. I'm so curious to know why this has worked so well in Richmond, California, and if this is more than just a short-term solution. I used to be of the opinion, you know, teach a man to fish, don't give him a fish. So
yeah.
I used to be against cash handouts until I did a breakfast grill with an organization that gave unconditional cash handouts to the poor, and they found that instead of, you know, the common belief that they would spend it on cigarettes or booze or drugs, poor people know what to spend it on best, how to get themselves out of poverty without anyone having to tell them what.
Also, I think there is such a high degree of trust deficit in the world. I mean, there's so much corruption, so much money lost to corruption.
Mm.
So giving money back to the people would be a way of actually securing this money so that you divert money from other causes which are not very palatable, like corruption, right? You divert money away from corruption.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you think. I mean, I'm going to tweet out this link regarding the program in Richmond, California. Tell us if you think we should pay potential criminals not to commit crime. Hashtag TellBFM. The Twitter handle is at BFM Radio, or you can text us at 016-201-9000. Hi there, I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng here with you this morning on The Morning Run. Now, we've tweeted out the poll on the Cash for Criminals program. So please have your say on Twitter. Yes, for paying potential criminals not to commit crime, or no? We've got 5 votes already. 80% say no, and 20% say maybe. Actually, with the maybe, you have to tell us why you've decided to that option on the poll. Why do you think there's a maybe here? Is it a grey area? Tweet us, hashtag TellBFM. We want to know your reasons for that. But in other news, Julian, you saw this really interesting article about building more houses, and that's the way to kind of reduce the household size in Malaysia.
This was written by Alan Tong on The Star last week. And Alan Tong, of course, is the guy that started, whose family started the Sunrise Group, which was eventually sold to PNB after it became very successful. And he is a long-time property man. And right now he manages, he's the chairman of Bukit Kiara Property. They have a lot of condominium projects over there in Bukit Kiara. And he thinks that the government has for a long time been railing against government moves to cool down the property sector. You know how we have the elimination of the DIBS and how Bank Negara wants to curb so-called speculation in property sector. And a lot of these property people don't believe that there is property sector, that there is speculation in the property sector, but rather an over demand in the property sector.
Okay, so what he's saying is just build more houses, and that would be the solution to everything.
Build and they will come.
Okay, so he's a property developer, right? Clearly, he, you know, this is part of his. It's
his
a good
mantra.
Thing, yeah. It's a good thing for him. Build more houses, but what he's saying is that build more affordable houses. So, you know, the type of houses you build, I think, is going to be quite important. One statistic that really stood out for me in this article is the fact that in Malaysia, the average household we have 4.4 people per household, and that's among the highest in the world. It's higher than China, it's higher than Indonesia, higher than UK and Australia. So in China, it's about 3 people per household, Indonesia 3.9 people, whereas more developed nations like the UK, it's 2.3 people per household.
So this is roughly equating to 2 parents plus 2 or 3 kids still living at home. I guess a lot of this
4.4.
A lot of this has to do with our high cost of living, and now we are forced to depend on parents. Not only are the cost of living very high, but home prices are also very expensive. So I'm not sure. I guess it's fine to say increase the supply so that the prices of homes would come down. But who would build these houses? Would developers step up to the plate and build more houses, or should the government do it?
Do you think that if there were more houses, people would buy it? Okay, so the more houses there are, the prices will likely come down, right?
Also, I think that, true, it really depends on what prices are. But I also think that the demand is definitely there. I mean, everybody who is like programmed into our DNA, right? When we grow up and have jobs like adults that we are, we would want our own homes rather than living with our parents.
But depending on the price. I mean, like you just said, depending
yes.
on the price.
Yes.
So what's also interesting is Alan Tong is saying that if you build more houses, the prices will naturally come down because, you know, more demand, more supply, and then you'll the prices will eventually come down, and that will generate more demand for property. I don't know. I mean, is that a build it and they will come, like you said, Julian, or is this, you know, not tapping into the market that's already there?
So the question is, why is this not already done? I guess he is, there is some kind of sub-narrative that is arguing that it's not done, I guess, because the government has imposed a lot of curbs in the way that property developers go around and do their jobs. I guess he is essentially saying that the government should not tinker around with rules in the property sector so that developers can do their jobs building homes. But, you know, developers will gravitate towards where there is most money to be made and not necessarily build affordable homes. So I guess combing through this article, I still can't find a solution as to how... Say if I accept your argument, how can this be done?
Okay, he seems to say, there's a quote in the article, we can't build our way out of the housing crisis, but we won't get out without building. Clearly, there's a need for affordable housing. I think it's a mixture of having government intervention saying that you have to build affordable housing rather than building high-end houses, which will give you the best profits, right? But also the need for property developers to know that even if I build affordable housing, which will give me lower margins, the quantity that I will get by selling these houses will exceed whatever profit margin I get by selling high-end houses. Do you think that's the case? A quantity game?
Yeah, it's very much a quantity game. But he also highlights another factor, which is that, and this is the closest the article comes to providing a solution, that the authorities need to streamline the delivery system, which means that all those building materials that you have, the quantity of land supply that's really in the hands of the government should be streamlined. The kind of rules that the government adopt to increase or decrease land supply, those kind of rules, I guess, should be streamlined. So for instance, in a country like Hong Kong, where we all know that home prices are extremely expensive, the government has a hold on land supply. So they will release more land into the market if they felt that property prices are rising too quickly. And in Hong Kong, some people commute for 1 or 2 hours because the government releases land far away from the central. And that's the other problem as well. If you release, Malaysia has a lot of land, right? Yeah. If you release land far away, are we creating an elitist society where only the rich can stay close to the city and all the rest of us?
Isn't that the case already? I mean, even here we see, you know, the city centre is where the rich high-end condominiums are, and that's where perhaps the expat community lives. Whereas further out in the suburbs, where the rest of us live.
That's right. So this is where the supply game comes in. How do you play around with supply that would create a very multi-diverse society where we have a mixture of backgrounds living in a certain township? How does Singapore do it, for example?
Because Singapore, is that the best model? I mean, okay, so it's the HDB, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so
Housing Development Board.
That's the program.
Yes.
Is that the best way to do it to ensure everyone has...
It seems to be working because the Singaporeans seems to be a society of house ownership, one of the highest in the world, and house prices in Singapore are not cheap. So how do the Singaporeans do it?
But it's all part under a government program, right? It's not privatized the way perhaps the rest of the world does the real estate sector.
Maybe that would be the route to take, a government initiative to provide housing. We have BRIM here already. Not BRIM, but the Prima housing program.
Okay, yep, that's for the
government is trying.
Housing.
Yeah, it's level best to provide housing to the people, but of course the system is one that can be abused. I think still you need, we go back to social programs, right? You need a kind of very solid housing program so that people can own homes.
For me, I've always had the difficulty trying to understand the affordable side. So, I mean, there's no, the definition under Prima is different from what the property developers define affordable housing. They have a certain cap, which is slightly different or higher than that of the government. So what they deem as affordable housing may not necessarily be all that affordable after all.
Yeah. Also, I think the costs of living, including property, have gone beyond the reach of what people are earning. There has to be national income issues as well. We spoke to Dato' Cheryl on a Breakfast Grill. He's the CEO of EPF. And he says that that retirement policies, and in this case, I guess we can extend it to housing policies, have to go hand in hand with a kind of national income policy.
Really?
Because our incomes today are insufficient to cater to our various needs.
There you go. You can download that podcast on bfm.my. Just search for EPF and find out more about what Datuk Sharul has. You know, he's got some really interesting ideas, which perhaps in the future we might see come to fruition.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.